KUOW 94.9 Seattle. I'm Steve Scherr. Crows and ravens, according to researchers like John Marsliff, have co-evolved with humans, learning our habits, learning where we keep our food, maybe even forcing us to work together to protect our foods. The corvid's place in human culture has been part of pictographs, carvings, and paintings for eons, an indication of their impact on their psyche. We take up their psyche, their impact on our psyche, and the crow's psyche as well. John Marsliff is Denman Professor of Sustainable Resource Sciences and Professor of Wildlife Science in the College of Forest Resources, the University of Washington. His book, In the Company of Crows and Ravens, was a collaboration with Tony Angel, who's a freelance artist and writer. His book as well, back out in paperback. Tony Angel, thanks for being here.
Nice to be here.
John Marsliff, thank you for being here again.
My pleasure, Steve.
First, we go to the field. Can crows recognize specific faces? Can they teach each other to fear a specific person? Last week, producer Katie Sewell went in the field with John Marsliff to test crow recognition, who they were recognizing, a caveman, or John wearing a caveman mask and a gardener's hat. The crows supposedly hate the caveman. Katie asked John how the crows came to hate the caveman so much.
500 days ago, they saw him catch other crows on campus. And what we found is that most of the scolding by birds on campus are by birds we didn't catch, but that either observed us catching, which we don't know, of course, because there's maybe 40 birds flying high up in the air as we catch a bird, scolding and learning about that situation, or they've watched other birds that are knowledgeable scold us in later trials. And we have some evidence of that because as we've gone on through time, and we've walked on campus with the caveman mask now maybe 40 times, and the rate of scolding has increased through time.
Do they ever actually physically attack you?
They come very close, and they'll follow oftentimes, but usually they don't come too close. And again, remember, what we did when we wore this mask is we caught them in a net, and we held them down and banded them and let them go. So we didn't hurt them, but we certainly gave the appearance of being a serious threat, that if you get too close, they might catch you. So they ought to stay away, really.
All right, so you have it on now.
Yeah.
And I see a crow in front of us.
That's a radio tag bird. I don't know if you could see that antenna on it, but that's not one that we caught wearing this mask. And yet it scolded and was clearly seems frightened. That's a scolding mobbing call directed at us, looking at us. But cautious, they're staying back a good distance, 10 or 15 feet. Others might come in now in response to this. That bird's not banded at all. That one's got a radio tag. So both of these birds had to learn indirectly about this because they weren't ones that we actually physically caught and banded with the mask on. Here comes another one in to join the scolding.
Why do you call it scolding?
They're attracting, they're giving an angry call, very low frequency pitch call, grating call, easy to localize, that allows others that hear it to know there's danger here. And they're coming into to this particular location. They're not trying to hide and give a high-pitched, hard-to-locate call. They're giving a very easily locatable one to bring others in to a dangerous thing.
Why do they want to bring others in?
To try to get me out of here. And more the better to push something like this out of here. And also, perhaps, what we've been learning is they're doing it to teach others that this is a bad thing. So it's not just for their own good. That's certainly part of it. But they also learn... They're also, I should say, teaching others that this is a bad person.
Now, there's a whole bunch of people around us right now. How do you think they know that you're the bad person, the ones that they're calling in?
Right. That's what's, I don't know. You know, in this case, if ones have just come in and they haven't experienced a caveman at all, maybe there's something in the quality of the call, where the birds are looking. They're following us. You know, so they're giving some other signals to the location of the bad thing. Or it could be that they have a specific label for, you know, this weird guy. I don't know. That's what we'll investigate next. If we can get away from him, I'll take the mask off and we'll walk back by without it and see if they respond to us. Because maybe it's your microphone.
It could be. Okay, so now you have it off.
Yeah. So now let's just walk back by that same area and see. Birds might still be kind of riled up.
And you don't even carry the mask with you.
I didn't want to carry it. You know, they could... We've tested them with the mask upside down, which is supposedly, if you really recognize just the facial features, if you scramble it like that, people and sheep and things like that can't recognize it as well. But these guys recognize it with it upside down too. But when we started thinking about it, they're always above us anyway. So they basically see our heads upside down all the time. And I've even had some birds turn their heads upside down when they look at you with that mask that's inverted. Here's a bird coming right with us here. Let's see if it does anything. Could tell it was almost a little bit confused, like, it looks familiar.
But nothing so far.
Nothing. This is a typical thing. It's back on the ground doing his thing.
That was Katie Sewell in the field with John Marsliff. On Monday, she visited Tony Angel at his home studio, a place filled with pieces of half-carved stones, preserved animal and bird specimens.
This is where I chop on stone, saw on stone, see in the stone something that might already exist there. In other words, I'm not really imposing something on it. I see a shape, and I kind of go with stone. This particular piece has a long history to it, but it was a piece of stone that I dug out of the Skagit River up along the bank above Marble Mount, and it was already to some degree shaped like a raven. And I didn't know what color it was going to be until I started to polish it up. But once I got it back here, my job was to saw, chisel, rasp, polish, and shape what I have here in this raven, which is probably about 28 inches high, 10, 12 inches across, the stone probably weighs about 200 pounds or so. I'm going to take you inside here and show you some things I'm working on. Believe it or not, I really cleaned this place up. You should have seen it earlier. It was just chaotic. This is without lights because putting the roof on, we burned out one of the wires. But we can still see in here with a skylight. This is a piece of slate that I'm carving. And it's slate that, believe it or not, I salvaged from a pool table. What I'll do is take a look at this, do a drawing, and imagine, can I get, in this case, three ravens or two ravens in different postures of flight. Behind you, over there, Kate, this is a piece of finished slate, and you can see over here, same, that's metal, that's slate, but if you look, there is the same bird right here that was in slate because I took a rubber mold off that surface and then cast this in bronze.
So when you go about chiseling something like this, describe what that's like. Perhaps even what it's like on the human body.
Oh, well, it is divine. I'm serious. Doing any kind of art, you're somewhere else. And when you get into the rhythm of carving, because I tend to be sort of a physical person, it's, I suppose, a lot like dancing. And you've got a rhythm, you've got a hand-eye coordination, and you really are in another space, another place. Mentally, I think the endorphins really kick in when you're going with the shape and the flow and the form of the stone. And then when you can step back and actually see you've got something tangible, then they really kick in.
So are there pieces of stone that you're given or that you, I don't know, come across that you look at it and you're like, no, there's nothing there?
Well, yeah, I'll have a piece of stone around the studio for years sometimes before I'll see what's there. You know, I'll be looking at it, and I just can't see it. I'll turn it over, I'll pick it up, I'll put it up high, I'll put it down low, I'll turn it around. And then one day, all of a sudden, and I don't know whether it's just the subconscious kind of takes over and comes to the conscious level, there it is, and I know exactly what I'm going to do. You know what kind of bird that is?
Looks like a raven crow.
Yeah, it's a raven. My God, you're 100%. All right, way to go. This is a raven, the head of a monument. Anyway, ravens and crows.
What's the obsession, ravens and crows?
Well, I think when something is pretty intelligent, you get the idea that they're watching you to figure out your next move. You become intrigued with them. You want to find out more about them. And they're also, from the standpoint of an artist, not only are you engaged in the mind of your subject, can you show its emotion? Can it appear to be clever and contemplative or what? But they're beautiful aesthetically, very expressive with their feathers, and never can seem to get enough of watching them. At least I can't. Someone brought over a raven to me who had gotten it, picked it out of a nest in eastern Washington. Of course, a raven being pretty big bird and hungry most of the time, she didn't know what to do with it. And so I adopted it for a while. I can't say I had it as a pet. You don't, as much as I do a companion. I mean, I do not exaggerate, Katie. The raven went down and tweaked the tail of the lounging husky who was off in the shade on the grass over here. And the husky just, okay. And off they went, racing through the woods. And being a big bird, the raven was making its way through the woods. And you'd hear this crash of the dog chasing and a croak of the raven. And around they came again. Here they're coming this way. And I waited to see what would happen. The raven looked back, see if the dog was behind it, and went right up under the porch, bam, and hit its head, and it was down on the ground. The dog had a lot of momentum, so it ran right up behind the raven. And both of them looked at each other like, okay, now what? You know, what are we doing? Because nobody's supposed to catch each other, right? The raven just kind of enjoyed irritating the dog, I guess. And the dog was, you know, how dogs like to play, too. You know, and he got right into the game.
So is there a difference artistically in working on, say, a raven sculpture to a crow sculpture?
I'm a little more inclined to the mystical moment with the raven, because I can't be indifferent to this extraordinary lore that accompanies the raven. It, you know, to a degree, the crow has its share, but nothing like the raven. I mean, my God, we're living in the Northwest, where some of the most reverential and respectful homage has been paid to the raven by the native people here. And having ravens around like it did for years certainly gave me a lot of ideas, and it's pretty exciting.
We are in the company of crows and ravens with John Marsliff, Tony Angel, both of who you heard talking to Katie Sewell. Let me go to Chris, who's at the UW. Hello, Chris. Thanks for calling.
I grew up in Seattle, and there's a little wooded area called Thornton Creek Park. And as young lads, my friends and I would play in the creek. And one day, a murder of crows came from the north and the southwest and the east. Large groups of these crows, and they convened in the park, dived on us and kicked us out of the park, basically. And as we sat at the edges, there was a large cacophony, and it lasted for about a half hour. And they were just, it was the loudest thing I ever heard. And they then dispersed in the same directions they came from. So it seemed like it was kind of a convention or some sort of a meeting.
Do family groups or non-territorial groups meet to share ideas?
Well, particularly do, of course, when they come to roost, and they can do that at different intervals. They may well have come in because of something you didn't see. Often it'll be a cooper's hawk or a red-tailed hawk or even an eagle that's in the tree that they see. And then, as we heard earlier in John's field work, the muster call is given, and in come the hordes of birds from all these different directions. The hawk flies off, you don't see it, and away the crows go. Or the crows will sometimes say, we're not going to move this creature. It may even be a roosting owl that you don't see. And they finally say, we're wasting our energy, we'll go back to the field.
Chris, thanks a lot. Are there queen or king crows in big groups?
Well, the territorial adult and female, male and female adult breeders are the king and queen of that space. But there are many of those. It's a dispersed ruling party.
It's a democracy. Let's go back to the field for a minute, too. Katie Sewell and John Marsliff went out in the field last week, and this was original plan was to tag baby crows wearing, Ken, you might be interested to know, wearing a Dick Cheney mask.
We're going to go and check an active crow nest to try to get the nestlings to put color bands on them so we can follow them at a later time. And most importantly, we're going to do it with a special mask on so that we can see if those young or their parents recognize us later when we wear that same mask versus don't wear it.
What are you hoping to accomplish by wearing the mask?
Getting these animals upset and learning about a new predator, and that is a guy that looks like Dick Cheney.
So this is kind of a test to see how well crows recognize individuals, right?
Absolutely. And do they recognize just our face or something else about the way we carry ourselves or what we happen to be wearing? So in this case, we change everything except the face. The face stays the same with the given mask, but you could band the birds with it on, or I could, or somebody else could, and we could change clothes and have a variety of different settings, but our face is always the same.
Aren't you already recognized by most of the crows in this area, John?
You know, I think they've forgotten. It's been probably 8 years since I banded a lot of them personally on campus. I've had my students doing that and they certainly know my students and hate them. but hopefully they've forgotten all about me at this point.
Okay, well, let's head on out.
Carry this.
Yeah, sure.
Because I'm going to have to grab this ladder.
Yeah. Okay. So could you have one person do only good things?
Yes, and that was the initial idea with Cheney. He was going to be the good guy. Cheney has tried feeding them peanuts and tried to do a lot of good things, and he couldn't win them over. And so now we'll have him ban nestlings.
Let's hope Cheney never visits once you have this established.
Well, you know, comes around, goes around. I'm going to Wyoming Friday. And maybe we'll teach the ravens to recognize Cheney there. They'll certainly see him there.
What do baby crows look like?
Oh, they're beautiful. They look kind of like miniature adults once they get fairly large. When they're small, they look kind of like flesh-colored footballs in the nest with big mouths, bright orange linings to their mouths or red linings so the parents can stuff them full of food. So don't look at them unless you want them to know you forever.
So he's in the mask. Here we go. So are you going to grab him and bring him down here?
Yeah, I'll bring him down in this pack.
Okay.
That's the idea anyway.
Good luck. He is now gone off the ladder and is way up in the treetop. Lots of dead branches falling down. It's one upset parent that we just heard.
They're too young.
They're too young?
Yeah.
How old are they, do you think?
A couple days, maybe 5 days. The mother wouldn't even get off the nest.
Really?
I looked right at her, and then she finally got off. Scolded a little bit, but really no bad reaction at all. And that's kind of interesting that they're so calm, you know, and maybe have really habituated to being around people.
Even a person in their nest.
Even in their nest. That's unusual.
John Marsliff is Denman Professor of Sustainable Resource Sciences and Professor of Wildlife Science in the College of Forest Resources, the University of Washington. His book, In the Company of Crows and Ravens, was a collaboration with Tony Angel, who's a freelance artist and writer. KUOW 94.9 Seattle. I'm Steve Scher.